Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, as always, coming to you once again from The Rock here in North Wales, the best place in the world to live. I've just gotten off the phone with Dave Warnock of Dying Out Loud. That episode is going to be coming up in just a few weeks. I've got some really great stuff lined up for you. In 2 weeks, we're going to be talking about religious trauma syndrome with psychotherapist Laura Anderson, followed by the episode with Dave Warnock. So there's some really cool stuff heading your way. In this episode, I'm kind of continuing the theme that I did in the episode from 2 weeks ago when I talked to Brady Harden. I'm talking this week with Bill Prickett. He is the co-host of the Recovering from Religion podcast. If you know anything about Recovering from Religion, you'll know that Dr. Daryl Ray is the kind of the founding member of that organization, as well as the Secular Therapy Project. I had Daryl Ray on the show a few months ago, and through Daryl, I was able to meet up with Bill Prickett. Now, this is an amazing story. Bill is a former evangelical pastor like me, comes out of that, but like Brady, struggled with same-sex attraction, and that's a big no-no in evangelicalism. You can't act on that. You can't do anything about it. And in Bill's case, not only did he go through some forms of what are now called conversion therapy, but he was actually promoting it as a way maybe to kind of cover his own issues and kind of provide that sense of religious cover. This is what I'm doing. I'm okay. So I'm going to let Bill tell you his own story in just a few minutes. I just wanted to mention thank you to the newest Patreon supporters. Had a couple people on there that actually didn't want their names to be mentioned because they're still kind of involved in evangelicalism and they didn't want their family to find out. So you know who you are. Thank you for supporting the ongoing work of the show. Now, one of the things that's changed, I wanted to mention this really quick before I get into the chat with Bill, and that is that I have finally bit the bullet. I have finally rid myself of my old website name where I used to host this show, which was The Preacher's Forum, which was also the original name of this podcast. And I changed it a while back, a couple years ago, to Mind Shift Podcast. So now, do not go to preachersforum.com if you want to find old episodes. I've changed the domain name. Everything has changed. It is now called mindshiftpodcast.co.uk. That is the name of my website where I'm now hosting this show. And I've actually gone through and done a major purge on a lot of the old articles and stuff that I was kind of leaving up on my old Preacher's Forum site. So I'm actually really excited, even though it meant it was a huge amount of work for me to change everything over. And it was very stressful to get all the feeds going. And I hope there's no interruptions, especially on iTunes. But hopefully everything will be all right. But if you go to mindshiftpodcast.co.uk, you can find some really helpful articles and links and things that I've been working on, as well as some links to my articles on Medium. So check out my new website, the new feed for Mindshift Podcast. Anyway, let's get on into it. I'm going to bring you now this conversation that I had with Bill Prickett talking about surviving conversion therapy. I'm so glad that I'm going to be joined here in this discussion with Bill Prickett. Now we have, I guess our connection in this is the Recovering from Religion, Daryl Ray, who was on the podcast not long ago. So that's our connection. That's how we kind of met up, isn't it? I think, Bill, where are you coming out of? You're coming out of Texas.
I live just outside of Dallas, Texas.
Dallas, Texas.
Yep.
You know, I've never been to Dallas, but except through the airport, which I guess that's probably true of a lot of people.
Yes. You can't get to heaven without going through the Dallas airport.
I think that's true. I've always wanted to see Dealey Plaza, though. That's one of my kind of bucket list things. It's a morbid fascination, but it's always a thing. You know, it's an iconic thing when you're in Dallas. You've got to go see.
Yes. Yeah. When my family came visited years ago, and we took them down there to see that. So it's history. It's so much because I was a kid in elementary school, but you remember where you were when that happened. And so, yeah, it was an experience. When I had lived here for a few years and hadn't gone myself, so we took the family and went down there.
It's amazing. There's so many things on your doorstep that you haven't seen. Oh, there's people that come visit and they've seen more stuff than we have.
It's true.
So you're out of Dallas. So the connection then is recovering from religion.
Yes.
Is Daryl Ray. Is he the founder of Recovering from Religion?
He is. He founded the organization. He's still the president. And it is an organization that helps people who are having questions or doubts about their faith, who have come out of extreme kinds of religious behavior or beliefs. And so Recovering from Religion has online a call center that you can call and talk with someone. The purpose is not to talk you into or out of your faith. It's to listen. We have a lot of resources on the website. It's a totally volunteer-run organization. There are no paid staff at all. And then we've connected up with our secular therapist program. If you want to talk with someone who approaches therapy from a secular perspective, and again, is not going to try to talk you out of your faith or demean you for having questions. And there are also local meetup groups around the country that people can connect with. So it's a great organization. I was honored to be asked to help them with their podcast and met some wonderful, wonderful people.
You were saying that you've been doing the Recovering from Religion podcast just about a year now.
About a year. We're coming up in November. We're coming up on our first anniversary.
So that's definitely a great resource. And I know, as we were saying, talking to Daryl in our podcast episode, fantastic resources. And I still can't get over the fact that, to me, it's one of the greatest ironies that you have to recover from religion, especially as, well, I'm sure we're going to find out, our background is both coming out of evangelical fundamentalist Christianity.
Yes,
but
yes.
But the fact that you and I have had to recover, maybe, I don't know, you more than me, because I'm interested to hear your backstory. We were talking a little bit before we hit record about you went through conversion therapy, and I want to get into that because I've never actually talked to someone like yourself who's gone through that. So what's your story? Were you were raised in it, born into it, or did you enter into it at some point?
You know, it's interesting. I wasn't raised in church. Growing up, we didn't go to church. My grandparents were very active, and occasionally we would go with them, but my parents were not. And my father was an abusive type, verbally mostly, but more so just of me. He came into our lives when I was about 7 or 8 years old. And I think he kind of realized that when he married my mom, he inherited this little sissy boy. And he kind of made up his mind he was going to fix that. So I started young, learning that certain behaviors were not appropriate, certain gestures, certain mannerisms, voice inflections. And so I kind of grew up learning to police myself, the way I talked or whatever. But then I went out of high school, my roommate in college invited me to go to his church and help their youth group with a drama presentation. I had done theater. And I went and helped them. And that's kind of how I transitioned into a church life. You know, I won't go into all the terminology of born again or whatever you want to call it. But I did become part of this group, and almost within a few weeks started going to this extremely fundamental Bible study. I mean, extremely fundamental. It was most of the guys at that age were, you were encouraged to join the military. And it was misogynistic, patriarchal, all of it. The emphasis was on studying and memorizing the Word of God. And so we'd come together on our weekly study, and one of the first questions you'd get asked, how much time did you spend in the Word this week?
Yeah, I got to do that. Was it a King James only, by the way?
It was structured around King James. The founder of this group out of Houston, Texas, predominantly used King James. I had, for some reason, started off with New American Standard Version because it was pretty new at the time. And I seemed to have a knack for studying the Bible, memorizing the Bible. So I began sharing what I was seeing, what I was learning. Then I was asked, well, why don't you lead the group this week, the leaders out of town or whatever. And it led, one thing led to another. And eventually I decided, well, this is what I want to do. So I went to college, went to seminary, and left that group because I began to see some of the problems with the nationalism and the extremism, and transitioned then into much more traditional evangelical thought and ministry. I went to a Southern Baptist college, Southern Baptist Seminary, did youth work, did pastoring, but all this time knew that I had this secret inside me. I knew that I was attracted to other guys. So knowing I wanted to go into the ministry, what do? You marry a woman who plays the piano. And thinking this is going to fix it.
Solve your problem.
Oh, absolutely. If I get married, I'll have a righteous outlet for these feelings and these sexual desires. And I think I loved my wife. I loved the ministry. And I think for many years that sublimated so much of what I was feeling. So it wasn't like a daily struggle against the desires of the flesh. It was there. It was a temptation, but it was more than anything. I was so immersed in the ministry, but then it began to crop back up after about 8 or 10 years of marriage. So I learned of groups that promised you could change your sexual orientation. We didn't call it sexual orientation back then. It was, we couldn't define it as a sexual orientation because that would be something inherent within you. It was these temptations and we could overcome them. And I began to get involved. I began to read books and go to seminars and go to a support group. And ultimately, again, as it transitioned, I began to speak out and people heard me speak and I was invited to speak churches on radio, on television, and eventually became the leader of one of these groups.
So you had a background in actually being a part of this conversion therapy,
yes.
Sort of the beginning, the groundswell of it. Called that back then. We're talking, 30 years ago?
This is in the early 80s.
Right.
And we didn't call it conversion therapy then. That's a relatively newer term. We just called it ex-gay or former homosexuals or various other terms, but it was all about learning to overcome our sin and be victorious and all of that. So we were ex-gays. That's what we called ourselves.
That is fascinating. So theologically, then they were casting it as, it's a sin problem. So it could be anything. It could be a gambling addiction, could be a sexual addiction in terms of acting out, or pornography, or homosexuality is one of those. And so was that the philosophy or the worldview behind it? God himself is going to help you become straight, as it were, correct
exactly.
The sin problem. And therefore, what was going to happen then? What were you going to do after he made you straight?
You would not have these feelings, these desires, these inclinations, attractions, whatever term we used at that particular time. It was labeled as any other sin. It is, you could point to 1 Corinthians 6 and list it with all the other sins. And so it was just a sin. Although, when you listen to it, it was typically, when it was talked about, it was elevated to some higher level because it is an abomination sin. It is the sin that God turns his back on you. It is the sin that you will not inherit the kingdom of God. So it's just like any other sin, except it's not. So there was always this dichotomy of it's just a sin, so we can overcome it. But then when they talk about it, it was more than that, and it was like the worst sin ever.
Why is it such a bad sin in the evangelical or fundamentalist worldview? Because like you say, it's somehow it's one of the top five or the top three or two.
depending on who's preaching at the time, it's the top. It's usually the top two or three.
And yet we find, ironically, that so as we've seen so many preachers, that the ones who have preached the loudest have themselves actually been trying to cover up some things, some skeletons in their closet. You think about a Ted Haggard, for example, some of these other famous mega church preachers that were railing, or Jimmy Swaggart, railing against pornography. And then you come to find out he's out running around with a prostitute and doing all kinds of stuff. So why is it, though, that homosexuality in the evangelical culture is such a big one?
I think there is this need in evangelicalism, fundamentalism, there is a need for a visible enemy. And so something we can point to, you need to be afraid of this. And so it's a way to create fear, and fundamentalists and evangelicals need fear for the control factor. And so we create this and make people afraid. You're going to go to hell. You cannot go to heaven. You cannot. You are an abomination to God. You make God sick. These are all things I've heard.
Oh, we've all heard it.
Yeah. And so there is this need for something tangible. And so this is one of those things that they can point to in their versions of the Bible that they will grab hold of and say, the Bible says this. And it's more interpretive, in my opinion, it's more interpretive than actual, than what's actually there in the original languages. But it's there. They can use it. They can raise money with it. And we've seen that all through the 70s. Jerry Falwell and some of them using it to raise money for the homosexual agenda.
The gay agenda. Yeah, that's a big one. They've sent out newsletters and flyers back before the internet. That was one of the big things. I remember talking with Conway and Siegelman a few podcasts ago, and they identified that back in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, as you say. Mm-hmm. One of the things that was they were able to mobilize evangelical and Catholic and fundamentalist voters to vote for a guy like a Ronald Reagan was on this plank of the gay agenda. Homosexuality and abortion, those were the two big
– those were the two ones, yes.
Topic issue.
And I think it was strategic on their part. I think they needed these causes to galvanize their voting base around somebody like Ronald Reagan. And so they, you know, if you look at it historically, we've also seen that, you know, they were covering up some racism that dates back to the Bob Jones University, some of the Bob Jones University scandals of their refusing to allow black students and those kinds of things. And so rather than come off as racist, they grab hold of these issues. Let's talk about homosexuality. Let's talk about abortion.
And as you say, it's a classic cult tactic as well. I'm sure we'll get more into the cult psychology, but you need an enemy. You've got to have someone or some entity to be able to point to and to take your followers and say, you know, as you say, that's the enemy. It's us versus them. And if we don't band together and stand up against whatever, fill in the blank, the gay agenda, then you've got nothing, haven't you? So, yeah. It's classic tactic.
And what it did for those of us who were wrestling, who were struggling with this, is it created such a negative self-image. It was so condemning and so shaming and guilt-ridden that we had to do something. We had to overcome this. So that's how ex-gay programs flourished in the late 70s into the 80s. They began to grow and multiply, and they were everywhere. And it was because we had been so beaten down that we have to change, and we can change because nothing is impossible with God. And so we bought into this mentality, and again, with the cultic aspect, if we got in and then begin to ask hard questions like, okay, I don't understand why this is not. Then we are questioned. We are, it's because the problem is not the program. The problem is not the theology. The problem is not the Bible. The problem is me. It's not working for me. It must be my fault.
Exactly. That's all. The God always has an escape clause. That's my kind of thing. I say it's never his fault, because if you think, if you trace it to some form of logical conclusion, it couldn't be that God created you to be this way, because that's absolutely incompatible with every. And they, so, from what I've understood, in their worldview, it has to be a lifestyle choice, and that's where they come down, isn't it? On the whole issue is, you're not born this way. This is not your normal sort of inclination. No, it is a choice, and it's a sin choice. Is that how you heard it?
Absolutely. And if you listen to the language that they use, it's all choice-based language. Words like lifestyle, because a lifestyle is something you have chosen to live. It's not what you have to live because this is who you're attracted to. You've chosen to. And then they build up this concept of lifestyle to be so debased and horrible that, you know, it's sins, it's drugs, it's multiple sex partners, it's orgies and all of this
debauchery.
Oh, absolutely.
You're out of control, man.
I even after I left and came out, I never found a lot of that. So I don't know.
Maybe you were looking in the wrong places.
I was in the wrong place. But it is the idea, again, of creating this horrible image of the gay lifestyle. Yeah, and so we have something to point to preach at or preach against. But again, as those who live it in their, it's so defeating for the individuals. And so you have people who come to these programs so desperate and so despondent, and they've been rejected by their families, by their churches, and this is their last resort. If you don't change, you cannot live in this house. If you don't change, we will disfellowship you. And so they come, and it's this last resort for them.
And that's a horrible place to be.
Yes.
I can't imagine, going back to the cult psychology of it, it reminds me of Robert Lifton's sort of criteria of cults. And one of the things is the demand for purity and what they do. And part of this purity culture, it must relate to some of the evangelical purity culture, because that's all about sexual purity, isn't it? And so, of course, their version of purity is one man, one woman. When they say family values, what they mean is a monogamous man and woman being married with children. And so that does not include any sort of same-sex marriage. I've been doing a lot of research on the family and dominion theology, and I've come across that all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
They're involved in a lot of the anti-LGBTQ agenda, not just in America, but, of course, in other places like Romania, Uganda,
absolutely,
around the world. And they that phrase, family value, we stand for family values, but that's code, isn't it? It means anti-gay. And I think, I don't know what you think about this, but there's another piece of this that I was thinking of, and that is in their worldview of theology, they say that God will only bless America if we have a sort of a pure nation, because we have that covenant status as God's somehow replacement for Israel. And so part of what I've heard in the rhetoric of evangelicalism is that if we allow that gay agenda to develop and flourish in America, God will actually judge us as a nation. Did you come across that sort of rhetoric as well?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I can remember, I think, I don't want to be definitive, but I think it was Bill Gothard, because I was very involved in the Bill Gothard ministry. But I think it was Gothard using history, saying God destroyed the Roman Empire because of homosexuality, and God will destroy this country because of homosexuality. So, you know, as someone at the time, even then I knew I was struggling with it. It's like, oh my, you know, if I don't fix this, I'm going to be responsible for the destruction of an entire country.
The whole country's on your shoulders, Bill.
It's my fault.
Got to stay in the closet, clearly.
I can't give in to these desires. And, you know, and there's all these fear tactics that, you know, Gothard used to tell us that the sins of the parents will carry down to the next generations. And so I would wonder when I'd have these thoughts or giving to a desire, is this going to kill my kids? Are my kids going to have these problems? Is somebody going to get sick because of it? And it's such a closed-in system, and it's so fear-based.
Very toxic.
It's very toxic. And, yeah. And so the people who came to the programs, you know, at best, what we could do for them, for what we did for us, was behavioral therapy. We taught how to behave differently, because I'm convinced that sexual orientation is innate, inherent, and unchangeable. Hmm. And anybody that tells you differently has never tried to change their sexual orientation. But you know, we learn to change behavior. We learn to act differently, talk differently. And we changed, the biggest change was our terminology. And so we didn't talk about, you know, that we no longer have the desires. We talked about, in Jesus' name, I'm free of these desires. And so it was always framed in a certain way.
That is amazing, because it immediately makes me think of Stephen Hassan's BITE model.
Yes, yes.
You know, behavior control, you just said it. Mm-hmm. Information control, thought control, emotional control. Those are all hallmarks of cults, aren't they? And everything you just kind of ran through, you've got to change your mindset. You've got to change your thinking. You got to stop acting a certain way and behave differently. And somehow all those pieces will change you fundamentally, I guess. And
yeah. Right?
I don't know.
And if you don't, then again, like as I said, there's something wrong with you. And if you kind of start trying to go against the grain, you would be ostracized, which is another cultic aspect.
And shunning and the
shunning idea. And so, you know, we were taught implicitly and explicitly that you are either in the program trying to, you know, become who God created you to be, or you were in the lifestyle. And it was framed that way to us, almost verbally. And so there was the either or situation. There was no way to be gay and a Christian. That was unfathomable. And so when I did ultimately make the decision to leave the group, and when I realized after 8 years, it wasn't working. I was not changed. I was still having, and I resigned my church. I resigned the ministry. My marriage fell apart. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I had to walk away from everything that I believed, everything that was precious to me as far as my faith was concerned, because I was told you can either be gay or you can be a Christian, but you can't be both. And so it took me years to be able to reconcile both of those in my life, because I was just as unhappy turning my back on my faith as I was when I was trying to turn my back on my sexual orientation. The either or concept just doesn't work for me. So
it's a double whammy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Janice Selby, she's been on the podcast a few times. Oh, she said the other day.
I love her.
Yeah. She said that religion, it's a double whammy because it traumatizes you while you're in the religion with all the beliefs and the religious scrupulosity and all the abuses. But then when you leave it, it's another whammy because you've lost your community. You've lost your friends, possibly family members who are still in it. And you've got the grief, the loss, the anger, the betrayal, the emotions that you've got to work through. So it's a double hit.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
It was very difficult
from religion.
Yeah, I was on the verge of suicide after that. I literally was sitting alone in a one-room apartment after I had, you know, my family, I was gone. And I was sitting in a room with a gun in my hand. And I was ready to go, because in my mind, I was a failure. I had failed at the most important things in my life, my ministry, my attempt to please God, and my family. And I was ready to end it all.
They put you in an impossible situation, though, didn't they?
Yes.
I hear that.
You're set up to fail.
Exactly, because if God doesn't come through for you, you're done.
Yeah, and it's your fault. It's your fault, not God's fault.
Because I've seen that same dynamic. Just for example, we went to an all-night youth convention thing years ago in Seattle, and I remember watching these young kids, 12, 13, 14-year-old youth group kids, up there crying and sobbing and weeping because they hadn't experienced the gift of speaking in tongues and saying, God, what's wrong with me? Why don't I have this gift that you clearly want to bestow on everybody?
Everybody.
Why, you know, and it's exactly that same bind, isn't it, where you're saying, well, why doesn't God come through? Surely he should. Isn't he interested in making you straight or giving you tongues or, you know, freeing you from some addiction or problem that you have in your life? It never seems to happen, though. But like, it's always your fault.
Right.
And you're screwed.
Yeah. And so it's set up. And so over the years, I've watched, because I literally left this world in the mid to late 80s. We didn't have the internet back then, so there was no, I didn't know any other way. I didn't know there was research that said sexual orientation was innate, or I didn't have research that showed all these people who had tried and failed. I just knew it didn't work for me. I heard all of these glowing testimonies of people who were living this victory life, and I'm going, why is it working for me? Comes to find out, because I've met some of those people later, it wasn't working for them either. That's what we were told to say.
Yeah.
We say what we want to happen, not what is real. We don't say what's actually happened. Hebrews 11, you know, faith is the evidence of things not seen. And so we spoke those things as if they were, so that they would be.
And it will come to pass.
Yeah. So I've come to find out.
Magical thinking, though.
It is.
It's magical thinking, if you break it down.
Yeah. It's this incantation. It is, and I have since taught that we lived in this incantation of speaking it so that we could live it. And so we would tell everybody, I'm free in Jesus' name. I'm an overcomer. I don't have the, and so, but for me, I thought, I guess if I just keep saying it, because it's obviously working for all these other people, but it wasn't. So over the 30 years since I've left, I've monitored these groups, researched, spoken out, written about it. And I've watched the language of it change. And so if you'd asked me 8 or 10 years ago, I would tell you that conversion therapy or ex-gay groups would vanish. But things have changed in politics here in the States. And we have a vice president who not only believes that homosexuality is a choice, he has endorsed conversion therapy. We have a political party that is in power that is part of their political platform. So things have changed and they're beginning to crop up again, but the language has changed. And so they call it conversion therapy, and they talk about living in holiness. They don't talk about being straight. They talk about living in holiness.
The language changes.
Yeah, they talk about celibacy and those kinds of things, but it's just a new coat of paint on an old rusty gun.
Well, it seems like that is a major change, isn't it? What I've seen in that is that you can have a same-sex attraction, but you just can't act out on that. Yeah. Isn't that kind of where that's what God's going to help you with? He may not make you, let's say if you're a man who's attracted to other men, he may not make you suddenly be attracted to women and never want, you know, to be and never be attracted to a man. It's not necessarily that. They're saying, well, you'll have same-sex attraction, but you need to be celibate.
Yeah, and they'll compare it to Paul's thorn in the flesh.
Yeah, maybe that's what Paul's problem was.
Yeah, that was Paul's problem, in addition to all of his other problems.
But, yeah.
And so they will say, well, you know, it's just like alcoholism. You just have to overcome it one day at a time. And so I hear all this. Our one ex-gay leader compare it to going to Weight Watchers. The language changes, but it's still the whole thing that if you have same-sex attractions, you are less than other Christians. you can never act on this. You will never experience true intimacy, true connection with somebody else. You are free to get married if you want, but you can only marry a woman. And believe God that he will make this a happy, healthy union, but you can never act on those feelings inside you. And some Christians today, it's really bizarre to watch, will even admit under pressure that God might have made you gay, but you still can't act on it.
But that's unbelievably cruel, isn't it?
It is cruel. It is.
Why would God do that?
That's the word for it. It's cruel.
It's cruel. God made me gay, but I can't act on it. So it's another burden that I have to now bear.
It's the big cosmic joke. I talk to gay and lesbian people who feel that the joke's on them. It's, you know, why do I have this? And it is such a burden, and it's such a struggle, and it's so to admit it, as you mentioned, you lose family, community, and sometimes in the culture, you become an outcast and a pariah. So it's very, very difficult to reconcile. As I saw even back in the 80s, I can live my faith, or I can realize this is what I feel and who I'm attracted to, but I can't do both.
But there is a possible other path. What do you think of? You can join a very liberal denomination, let's say.
Mm-hmm. I am a part of that.
Yeah. So what about that as a possible path? You could say, well, what about some of the more inclusive, open, and affirming Christian denominations? Of course, the fundamentalists would denounce them completely.
Exactly. Exactly.
But and is that that's what something I was raised in?
Yeah. I'm an active member in a inclusive church that's a part of an inclusive denomination. As I said, it took me years to come to the place where I could realize I can maintain faith. I couldn't hold on to my fundamentalism. Of course, I had to let go of so much. But I still can hold faith. Most of my fundamentalist friends would tell me I'm apostate by these days.
You're liberal for sure.
Oh, I am. And and I can still then embrace who I am. So I am now openly gay. I'm married. We've been married. We've been together for 22 years. So, and we're both involved in a church. So it is possible, but not in the ex-gay world. In the ex-gay world, it is still black and white. You can either or. It's not a way to combine those two.
So what's your advice for someone who was in your shoes? So if you're, you know, imagine you're now speaking to a young Bill, but now you're having gone through all this stuff, and I know you must speak with, I don't know how many people that you speak with on a daily, weekly basis, but what do you tell them if they're struggling with, you know, they're being told all the things that we've been saying, it's a sin, it's a lifestyle choice, and blah, blah, blah. What do you tell that person?
I tell them to do the research, because we didn't have that when I was looking at this, that we didn't have this information, but it is out there on the internet. Do the research, learn what these programs actually do as opposed to what they promise they're going to do, because they make a lot of promises. That we can do this and you will change. They'll even give you statistics. There was an organization several years ago that advertised this weekend retreat for men. And if you went on this weekend retreat, your same-sex attractions would diminish by as much as 30%. I don't know how the hell you measure that. But so do the research at what they're promising as opposed to what they're actually delivering. Ask the hard questions. What is your success rate? What do you mean? And do the research. Find out who's going to be doing the programs, because most of the time they're not trained mental health professionals. They may at most be ordained in some church. They're probably someone who was struggling with it themselves. And now they've, like I did, I was struggling with it. And then ultimately I became leader of a ministry. So do the research, talk to people outside your little echo chamber, and find out some of the some of the statistics, some of the studies that have been done, but make your own choice. Don't be forced to make a choice out of fear and pressure and the condemnation that is possible there.
It certainly is, because as we know, going back to the cult psychology, as Robert Lifton says, with this purity culture thing, it's a classic tactic, because they put these standards on you that are impossible to achieve, and then they know you're going to fail. So when you then confess that you failed, you've given in to whatever sin is their standard, then they can better control you by manipulating the guilt and shame mechanisms, right, levers of control. So the whole thing, you're in this milieu, as Robert Lifton would say, where they're controlling everything and controlling the person by putting these impossible standards on you. So it's I can't imagine being in that scenario. I was going to ask you, too, how much of it is an American, particularly American thing? Because here in the UK, we don't see this, we don't hear the same kind of language. There's a little bit of it, but nothing like it is in the States.
Yeah, there are some. There are some in the UK. A dear friend of mine was one of the founders and leaders of a group in the UK, but he ultimately came to the same place I did, and he transitioned his group then to be a support group for people who were coming out of a faith background and realized they had these feelings. So it has been exported from the U.S. into Latin America, into Africa, and it has had some devastating results in these countries that will kill somebody when they even are suspected of being homosexual. And so you over there, it's even more so combined in the political culture of that day, where the churches preach the how horrible homosexuality is, and that you can change, you should change, you must change, and if you don't, you're murdered. Yeah, so it was exported from here. It started, most of what we tracked down started in the Jesus movement in the 70s in Southern California, and in San Rafael, California, in Northern California. So those are two of the historic beginning points for the what we now call the ex-gay movement.
You certainly would not want to be a gay person in a place like Uganda.
No.
For sure. Because as you say, there have been people, maybe they weren't even gay. They were just accused of being gay.
Suspected. Yes, exactly.
Dragged out, stoned, or stomped to death right out in the street. There's been videos. You can see them on YouTube and other places. So yeah, the seedbed comes out of places like Southern Cal in the 70s. But now, as you say, it's being exported. Because I was thinking that, you know, my oldest daughter, she recently got married. She came out about 7 or 8 years ago. And because we live in the UK, it's a lot more open, and this kind of the general feel here is a lot less oppressive. Yeah. I don't know if things are changing in America, though. But for her journey was a difficult one, because we were coming out of evangelicalism about that same time that she felt like she could tell us, even though we had figured it out years before. You know, we were like, we knew. We figured it out years ago, you know. But it's interesting to be in a different place, isn't it? I mean, when I go back to the States, I see the kind of oppressive evangelical culture. It's kind of striking because I've been over here so long. It's just a way to look at things.
About five or six years ago, a group of us who were all former leaders in this movement, we were at different places in different parts of the country, but we all came up and led organizations and groups. And each one of us, in our own time, in our own place, came out, left the ex-gay world, and we banded together into an alliance of former ex-gay leaders. And we began speaking out, politicians, church leaders, legal organizations working to ban conversion therapy for minors in the United States. We've been doing that. Originally we had, I think, 6 or 7 leaders, and now we have nearly 20, and represent probably more than 100 years of ex-gay experience combined. And we all know, we can speak definitively, it does not work. And so when somebody says, I think it works, I think you can do that, every time I say that it doesn't work, somebody's going to send me a YouTube video and says, yeah, well, what about brother so-and-so? So,
but it's not just limited to evangelical Christianity, is it? Because I read an article about, I can't remember the statistics, but there's been a shocking number of Mormon teens who can't, well, they weren't able to come out as gay. They ended up committing suicide.
Right.
Because they're put in that same bind, though, as you were describing. You will not be allowed into heaven if you're gay. You cannot be gay and be Mormon. And they're going, what do I do? The answer is to kill myself.
Yeah, and there is a high suicide rate there. It's estimated that 40% of homeless teenagers in the States are LGBTQ, who were kicked out of their house for that reason when they came out. And the suicide rate among teens is LGBTQ teens is significantly higher than among teenagers in general. The same among, especially among teens that came out of an unsupportive family background. So there is that, you know, within the Mormons, within the Catholic faith, especially within evangelical fundamentalism, it is such a pressure that you must do this. And if you can't, of course, there's something wrong with you, and it reflects badly on the family. It reflects, you know, on the church. And so they're ostracized.
Well, and I think too about that garden variety sort of evangelical Christian who's a lovely person, super nice, pays their taxes, doesn't hurt anybody, goes to church every Sunday. For them, it's a wonderful experience. They've got a great community. They've got all the support. And I say, yeah, but you're propping up a system. Look at what it's doing to those teens that you just described. What about that? You're part of a system that has one of its major messages is what you just described. What about that? You're part of a system.
And they don't think about it because it doesn't touch them.
That's it.
They are those nice people that you talk about. And so it's never, they don't think they, I've had those nice people to me. I don't know any gay people. Well, that's because the gay people are not going to tell you because of who they know you to be.
They can't risk coming out, really.
No,
it could be their kid, their child, their son, their daughter, who'd end up on the streets, as you say, if they dared to tell mom and dad. I mean, our daughter was terrified to tell some of our family members because of that same reason. They were staunch evangelicals, and they was the last, some of the last people that she finally told with the help of myself and my wife. We were able to have those conversations, and it turned out quite good, luckily, in that regard. You know, but I remember she was terrified to tell some of our family members for that very fear of the reprisals and the loss of community, because she loves her family, but she couldn't countenance the idea of losing those relationships over something that was fundamental to who she is.
Yeah, it's hard to make that choice. Do I choose to finally be at peace with myself and then in conflict with everyone I love? It's not an easy decision, and culture, especially religious culture, does not make it easier.
Certainly doesn't. Is that what your new book is about? You were saying you have a new book coming out in just a few weeks. What is the topic and title of the book?
The title is A Double-Minded Man, and I've had people tell me for years that I need to write my autobiography because I was involved in this early on, and it's a dated reference, but my life has been kind of an e-ticket ride. But I've never been interested in writing an autobiography. I'm way too morbidly introspective, and I feel like it would come out as a dark Stephen King novel if I wrote it about me. But I thought I could tell some of my story through the eyes of a fictional character. So I created a fictional character. I placed him in my hometown of Birmingham, Alabama, in the mid-80s, which is when I was living this. He's on staff at a very conservative evangelical church, and he's struggling with these issues and these questions. And so It's not autobiographical, but it is in some of my experience. We share experience. So he gets to experience these questions. He begins to go to a ex-gay group that his church sponsors. And we watch his journey of trying to reconcile the beliefs that he's always held true with these desires that he's always hidden. And so it's his conflict and him trying to resolve this. And so he is the double-minded man that James chapter 1 talks about, who's unstable in all of his ways. And it's his journey of trying to live his truth with the pressures of everything that he holds to be true.
Who's your intended audience? Who would you say needs to read this book? If you had one sort of intended audience in mind to read it, who would that be?
I think anyone who's asking the questions about sexual orientation, whether it's a kid who's struggling with it or parents who may be worried about their kid, because it is fiction. It maybe is a, you know, it would get in a way that if I gave them a doctrinal thesis on, you know, sexual orientation, might not. And so it maybe the fiction would give them a way to read the story and kind of understand in a maybe a different way than they might otherwise.
So yeah, it's for it anyone who's wants to explore that, whether they're coming out of a situation like you were, or someone who wants to just learn more about what someone goes through. Either way, it's going to be an educational read.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's really good.
I think it's more universal because at the core of it, it's a love story. It's there's the struggle of, can I love somebody this way? And so it has all of those elements. It's not strictly for somebody who struggles with their sexual orientation. It's not somebody who's raised in the Deep South, as this book, you know, says, or even somebody who's out of a religious background. I think it's got a broader appeal.
Right. How can people get a hold of you if they want to talk more with you about the book or your own story? What's the best way to reach you?
My website, BillPrickett.com. There are links there to email me. There's a link there to my Facebook page. I'm very active on Facebook and I have a wonderful community and we're very interactive. I write on my Facebook page, whatever's, you know, it could be, I may talk about ex-gay stuff. I may talk about politics. Today I've been talking about old TV shows. So okay. It's a very diverse Facebook page.
Right. It's not the same rants every day.
No, I rant about different things on different days.
Yeah. My wife says I'm like, a ranter and I say, well, someone's got to do it.
Somebody's got to do it. And so BillPrickett.com is my website. The book will be out on October the 4th. Amazon, it's available on Amazon and most, it will be available on most platforms and in local bookstores, paperback.
Of course, they can catch you on the Recovering from Religion podcast.
Yes.
How often do the episodes drop? Is it once a week or what are they, how often do they drop?
With the best of intentions in a perfect world, it's every other week.
Right.
We tried the every week thing. But then we think, you know, every other week. So in a perfect world, yes, every other week we have a new episode that's dropping tomorrow. But and we've shared some guests. When I was listening to your podcast, I see that we've had some of the same guests on. So there is synchronicity.
There is. And anytime you start talking to people about recovering from religion as you're doing, that's what I've been finding. It's that community, isn't it? You start talking to the same people.
Yeah.
You need to talk to so-and-so and you should talk to her and you should talk to him. And pretty soon we're just kind of making the rounds and talking to each other. I hope someone's listening.
Yeah, we're incestuous.
Yeah, incestuous, but we're recovered from religion, hopefully.
At one stage or another, we're at various stages. And that's what's so interesting about our podcast is we have people from, we've done Christian Scientists. We interviewed a guy who came out of Hare Krishna. We've done so many different backgrounds. Bill Gothard. And so we've done a lot of different people, different stories, but there's such a thread of similarity. Some have abandoned faith and are now avowed atheists. Some are questioning. As myself, I tell people I'm probably an agnostic Christian. Mm-hmm. But I don't own that term Christian anymore. So we're at various places and various stages, but it's so welcoming and accepting of one another. I have loved that about the recovering from religion folks that I've met.
Well, and I wonder too, if this is becoming a more global worldwide thing, where as that community starts talking to each other with the advent of the internet, you've got, like you said, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and instant messaging. The fact that I'm here in North Wales and you're in Texas and we're talking right now as if we're sitting across from each other in the room. That's amazing.
It
and
is.
I wouldn't have met you other than meeting, Daryl Ray and some of the other people. So that's a great community, isn't it? So I'm excited to see where this is all going. I don't know where it's going to be going, but I love to be a part of it. I'm glad that you're along this journey as well.
Thank you. And I do think it is growing, and the internet is helping people. We get emails from people that found the podcast or found the Recovering from Religion website, and they felt so alone. And then they realized there's other people. And I know, growing up gay and finding there were other gay people. And then when I came out of the ex-gay world and realizing there are other people, it's so empowering when you realize I'm not the only one.
That is hugely important, isn't it? If you have to form a new tribe, which you might have to do, it's out there. Mm-hmm. And like you say, I think so many people, I've heard the same exact line. I thought I was the only one. Right. I thought I was crazy. And then I found out I'm not crazy. I'm not the only one. There's tens of thousands, maybe millions of people all over the world who have had similar experiences to mine. And like you say, it's hugely empowering because it gives language to our experience, doesn't it? You say,
yes,
that happened to me. Someone can say, that's my story. And that's hugely important. So I'm glad you're out there speaking out. I'll let you go because I know I'm sure you've got stuff you need to do. You got a podcast to get ready. I've got a podcast to get ready for this week.
Well, thank you. So, thank you for having me, Clint. I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely keep in touch and let me know when your book drops and we can put a link to it in the show notes.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Bill. I've really appreciated chatting with you.
Thanks.
Well, I just want to say that you're not crazy. You're not the only one. There are, as Tobias says on Arrested Development, there are dozens of us. No, there's more than dozens of us. There's tens of thousands, and as I say, maybe even millions of people who are coming out of religion, out of cults, out of situations like Bill described, very toxic situations that are very damaging. Religious trauma syndrome, it is a real thing. Now, speaking of religious trauma syndrome, this is something that I'm going to be talking about in the next episode of Mindshift Podcast with Laura Anderson. She is a psychotherapist. One of her specialties is dealing with religious trauma syndrome, and we had a fantastic discussion all around generally speaking about what trauma is and then easing that into specifically religious trauma syndrome and how people can cope with that. What are some good strategies? Talked about triggering and other things that are very debilitating. Now, I've also had a conversation, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, with Dave Warnock of the Dying Out Loud organization. Dave is speaking all over the country, and he's planning a trip, hopefully, to the UK at some point next year. So I'm hoping to meet up with Dave in person. It's an absolutely amazing story. So stay tuned for that. Those two episodes with Laura Anderson and Dave Warnock coming your way in the next few weeks. Some really cool things, too. We've got Laura Anderson dropping into our monthly Mindshift podcast group Zoom call. She's going to be talking about religious trauma syndrome and triggering and how you can deal with that. So I am super excited. Also in November, we've got Brady Harden coming back in. He's going to be a guest on our next Zoom call. So these are some great benefits that you get from being a Patreon supporter of Mindshift podcast. Another cool thing is you're going to get a discount for Janice Selby's Court 2020, the conference on religious trauma being held in April of 2020 in Vancouver, BC. If you're a Patreon supporter of Mindshift Podcast, that will enable you to get a $60 discount on your tickets for the conference, and I highly recommend the Court 2020 conference. So if you want more information about that, go to my new website, mindshiftpodcast.co.uk. You can find out information on how to support me on Patreon, as well as looking at some other articles and things I've written on the site as a blog. So thanks for joining myself and Bill. I'll see you in 2 weeks with Laura Anderson as we talk about religious trauma syndrome. I'll also say, if you want to follow me, get a hold of me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can send me a message there if you want to chat. I'm always up for talking to new people. So thanks for listening in with myself and Bill Prickett. I'll catch you in 2 weeks with Laura Anderson right here on MindShift Podcast.